This episode is brought to you by Seminary Now, a streaming video platform that offers masterclass-style courses from more than 60 leading Christian thinkers, including some amazing New Testament, Old Testament scholars, and including my course, Managing Anxiety. You can get unlimited access for just $14 a month when you use the discount code CUSS30 at seminarynow.com/CUSS.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
All right, friends. Hey, welcome to a new episode. My guest today is Dr. Kathleen Smith. Kathleen is a licensed therapist. She's a Bowen theory or systems theory expert, and she's the author of Everything Isn't Terrible, Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down. Man, what a book. She released the book in 2019. I read it soon after that, and it immediately became one of my all-time favorite systems theory books for a couple of reasons. The number one is it's just so practical. Kathleen really helps us understand what systems is and how we can apply it. But also, it's so much fun. She really picks up the playfulness that comes along with systems theory as she lets us sit in on her therapy sessions with her clients. Man, what a great read. I've recommended this book to so many people. Kathleen is also an associate faculty member at the Bowen Center for the Study of Family. I have been excited to interview her for some time, and I began by asking Kathleen what got her into Bowen theory.
Well, I was an anxious graduate student who needed an internship. I was at George Washington University, and a woman named Dr. Carrie Collier, who was a few years ahead of me, had recommended this place that she was a part of called the Bowen Center over in Georgetown and D.C., and I went over there, and these people said, well, we might let you intern, but you have to do our training program first. And you need to work on yourself and your family for a year. And I went, this is interesting. Nobody else is making me do this work on self. I'm gonna try this out. And I started reading and learning about systems thinking and Bowen theory. And I've kind of been hooked ever since because while I did not grow up immediately, I could immediately see some of the ideas and concepts in myself and in my family and in other places. And it was like sort of putting these interesting goggles on for the first time. And I wanted to keep doing that. And so they haven't managed to get rid of me yet.
So. Yes, you often teach at the Bowen Center, but you also use it a lot in your own private practice with clients. What is it about Bowen theory versus, like, you know, as a psychologist, there's so many different avenues you can take. What is it about Bowen theory that you find to be most helpful for people?
Well, it's just a way of thinking about humans. It's not necessarily the way, but it's one way. And I think it's a way that is kinder, striving to be more objective, while nobody can truly ever be 100% objective, right? But it's just, you know, when you can stop labeling behaviors or patterns as maladaptive or dysfunctional or diagnosing, right? And you can start to say, yeah, it would make sense that humans do this to calm. But is there something else we can do? You know, and I think it's a way of not being so hard on yourself when you do what's automatic and what's predictable for anybody. And that, to me, that kind of adds some relief and takes the load off. And I can move past blaming myself and being interested, you know, in what I want to do differently. And that, to me, that's huge. And I hope that I help other people do that too.
Yeah. Oh, great. So Bowen famously has 8 concepts, and they've been written about by many people, and the Bowen Center has them on their website. They're easily Googleable. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you would just grab 3 or 4 of them for us that might be your favorites or the ones that you think, man, this just really helps people in 2023. What's interesting about Bowen is, you know, he iterated these concepts in the 1960s, and yet many of them really have, they really are universal. So what would be 3 or 4 out of the 8 that you'd want our listeners to know about and why they're helpful?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the central concept is differentiation of self. You know, how do I think for myself while staying connected to important people? How do I balance that individuality and togetherness that's just part of the ride of being a human? You know, that's sort of the lens through which you see everything, right? You know, Dr. Bowen thought, what are the variables that affect families? How do some families manage to do better than others? Why are some people more emotionally mature than others? What's that about, right? And he said, well, there's two big variables. There's the level of maturity, that's the level of differentiation. And then there's the level of anxiety, which we can't really do that much about, right? But things happen that are out of our control, right? But here's a variable we can play around with, you know, that isn't necessarily fixed. That can change a system. And so thinking about everything through that lens of how do I stay connected to all these people and hold on to my good thinking? I mean, that's helpful for any challenge, right? And so that's sort of the central concept of the theory. And then some of the more tangible ones, I mean, I think obviously triangles. If people... Yeah. That's the one I think that people take away the easiest, although I think it can be sort of the hardest to understand in some ways. But just recognizing how much of our week and weekly anxiety gets managed through triangles. You know, I come home at the end of the day, or my husband comes home and I tell him, oh, this thing is going on at church. I've got... You know, or what this happened with my work, or this is what our kid did today. You know, that's a triangle. Or relaying messages to people about other people, using people as a buffer, complaining or venting or gossiping to people. I mean, so much of our calmness comes at that cost of involving others, right? And keeps us from learning to manage our anxiety in a different way. So I think, you know, that's one of the things, at least with folks I work with who don't necessarily want to learn a ton about the theory, that's something very tangible that they can kind of be on the lookout for in their day-to-day life, are those triangles, you know? I mean, the one I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is not a simple one, is this idea of societal emotional process. I mean, you've been looking at everything that's going on in the world, you know, this week in particular, and you see footprints the right word, but fingerprints, let's say, of what humans do when you dial the anxiety up. You know, you see it in your family, but you also see it in the broader world. We get, what do we do to calm down? We avoid, we distance, we become over-involved with other people's actions and responses and responsibilities, right? You got the triangles. We pull other people in to how we manage it. And you see this on a broader scale in society. And so on a stressful week, this is sort of what I'm on the lookout for, is can I kind of step outside of all this for a second and see what are the predictable ways that people respond to threats? And they're always there. And that's really helpful for me to kind of wrap my brain around. So yeah, those are three off the top of my head that I've been thinking about lately.
The societal emotional process is fascinating to me. I'm on Twitter. Probably 50% or more of the reason I'm on Twitter is to practice being a well-differentiated self. Because my brain tells me, I mean, I'm not proud of this, Kathleen, but my brain tells me what the world requires is one more comment from me. And then I actually believe that the world needs me to put someone in their place, which is unbelievably arrogant and self-righteous of me. So I actually go on Twitter because that's a great avenue to see societal emotional process in real time. And man, even as somebody who teaches this work, I still get so quickly wrapped up in it. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, I am on Twitter frequently and I am not proud of myself for that, I'll say. But I think that is that perfect example of what Dr. Bowen called being irresponsibly over-involved with others, getting very fixated on other people's immaturity. I'm so good at that.
Yeah, you're a therapist after all.
It is. Exactly. And it is such a sneaky way to calm yourself down, even though it might not feel like it. It might feel like it's making you more anxious, but having somebody to blame or be irritated at is actually quite convenient for kind of feeling a little bit steady. And it's such an easy thing to do. And so, yeah, I mean, you have to be very careful about that. But yeah, if you want to see that process, I mean, you go to social media or anywhere online and you'll see it for sure.
Yeah, I often tell when we have students, I say, why don't you just go on Facebook and simply keep posting the following comment? Are you going to let her get away with that? Just keep putting that in there. Are you going to let her get away with that? And then just watch the anxiety spiral. You mentioned differentiation of self. It's, you know, Roberta Gilbert calls it the cornerstone concept. I think Murray Bowen would say this really is the foundation of all of it. Gosh, Kathleen, I've been teaching differentiation for years. Every time I have a guest on who is trained in Bowen theory, I ask them to define it because it is hard to grasp. How would you define differentiation of self?
Yeah, I would say the ability to put your best thinking into action while connected to other people. It's really easy for me to hold on to my best thinking when I'm alone or I'm imagining how things will play out. It's much harder when my child is screaming or I can sense that somebody's upset with me. That's very difficult. It almost immediately flies out the window, right? recently I've been talking about it as hanging in there, which is very vague. But it's useful for me. Can you hang in there when your kid is distressed, when everybody's worked up and so easy to just skip that meeting or, you know, or slowly back away? Can you hang in there and not do what you normally do? You know, that's the challenge. And that's a different way of thinking about differentiation.
Oh, man, I've never heard that as a definition of it. That's wonderful. Murray Bowen, I think, provocatively suggested that whatever family of origin we were born into kind of locks in our capacity to grow in differentiation. I personally disagree. As a person of faith, I feel like I have this power to help me become significantly more differentiated. I may be wrong, though, Kathleen. I kind of feel like Murray Bowen is teaching differentiation and family of origin almost like the old caste system in India. Whatever caste you're born into, you can kind of go up or down a little bit, but you'll always be in that caste. I'd love to get your take. I think Bowen said he only moved a few digits up the scale of differentiation. I may have him wrong. What's your take on the capacity for a human to really grow in that area versus be stuck?
Well, this is a great debate, you know, whether his outlook on that was pessimistic, optimistic, objective. I don't know how helpful the scale is because how can you really know? I mean, I think measuring that is so hard because we use so many things to prop up our sense of self. It's almost impossible to tell. You know, I can do pretty good on a day where people have said some nice things to me and nothing has gone wrong. So I have this inflated sense of how mature I am. But a different way of thinking about the scale or the numbers, though, is there's sort of an infinite amount of space, let's say between 36 and 37, right? Mm. Like, you know, and I'm always focused on the taste that I get when I have managed to hang in there. That's what keeps me interested. So it's not so much how far I can go in the course of my life as it is what the difference it has made in me thinking about growing up a little, you know, or focusing on myself rather than everyone else, you know, not that I'm considering myself particularly mature, but I think this about some of the old ways I might have done some things and how I could not live that way now, how stressful that seems to me, that makes me want to keep at it, right? So even those small changes add up to so much in my day-to-day life about how I might approach a problem, or maybe even take a second before I respond to somebody, that to me, that's huge. So I'm just less caught up in how much a person can really change over the course of their life versus the difference day to day, that staying at it can make, you know, so I think I'm maybe more optimistic, like you said, for reasons of faith and, maybe just better being a more optimistic person.
Yeah.
But, it makes a difference, and that's sort of all that matters to me. Not so much the quantifying that.
It's really encouraging to hear it, because I look back at my 20-something self, and now let's just say I'm in my 50-something self, and I barely recognize that young, anxious man, you know, very earnest and well-meaning, but so much more of the same and try harder, so much. I mean, I would need to anxiously calm other people down so I could be calmed down. That would almost describe my 20s, and I look at how I am now. It just does feel like I'm a long way from there. So I appreciate that invitation to see the scope of our life and the chance for us to be well. I think the core thing about Bowen theory that I keep being stunned by is the counterintuitive move to stop focusing on others, whether I need them to be well or whether I'm blaming them, I'm focusing on them. And then the counterintuitive move instead to look at myself, and I keep being fascinated by how much I'm contributing to the problem. How do you help people begin to focus on themselves when they're coming in frustrated in their relationships?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the classic answer is you ask people, what have you been doing and how has that worked out? Dr. Bowen and others would make jokes like, well, I think you just need to try a little bit harder at fixing your mother, and then I think you're going to get there. Just that humor of, well, it doesn't seem like what you're currently doing, so let's try something different, you know? But I also think it's very simple, and this isn't just what people would use as a therapist or a clinician, is just asking people questions like, what do you think you're going to do? What's the best way forward here? What can you control? I can't talk today. Who is the person you're trying to be in this relationship? It's all about the nature of the questions you ask too, right? But I think this idea of, you know, from Dr. Bowen, that a person who's being more responsible for themselves is naturally becomes more responsible to others, right? And how there is this equation, and that one person operating a little bit more flexibly, a little more thoughtfully, while it is not a magic solution and does not necessarily change others, it certainly creates a greater possibility of it. And I think people can kind of wrap their minds around that. Like, oh yeah, if I dial down some of the anxiety in this equation, people might get to access the front of their brain too. If I'm accessing the front of mine, you know, they certainly aren't going to be if I'm reacting, right? And so, you know, that not always, but often that makes people want to play around with it. And not so much I'm going to change myself so that you change too. It's like I'm doing this trick on you, right?
Yeah.
Instead, thinking of it as, let's loosen things up a bit. Let's get creative. Let's not get stuck in this rigid pattern. Let's see what, play around and see what happens. You know, that can be surprising, and people start to get encouraged because they do see progress. They do see a little bit of their own capacity, and that makes them maybe want to see more of that.
Okay, so let me let the cat out of the bag, Kathleen. I think I've read almost every systems book I can find in the 20-something years, and I mentally categorize them into earnest and playful. So Gus Napier and Whitaker's book, The Family Crucible, wonderfully playful. Ed Friedman's Fables, wonderfully playful. I'm not going to name some of the more earnest ones, but Kathleen Smith's Everything Isn't Terrible, wonderfully playful book. You wrote this in 2019, And I'll just remind people, you know, obviously in the introduction I mentioned it, but the book is Everything Isn't Terrible, Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down. What a great subtitle. What I love about this book, Kathleen, is two things. Number one, the way you lay out the sections. Part one, your anxious self. Part two, your anxious relationships. Part three, your anxious career. Part four, your anxious world. You're giving us these concentric circles starting with ourselves. But the second thing I love about it, it's so much fun to read. And I subscribe to your email newsletter. I'm going to put a link in the show notes for folks. It's my favorite email newsletter because it's practical and playful. Where did you get your playfulness from?
That's a great question. I have to say my family, right? I can't do that. Growing up, had two wonderfully creative and playful parents. I'm also a fangirl, which I love stories and television and books. And it was, you know, writing the book, it was such an interesting experiment because I'm a big TV fan. I could talk about television all day. And I wanted to use TV quotes in the book, and I've used that in all the books I've written. And I thought, oh, no, nobody does this in the Bowen theory world. There's that going away from self, right?
Yeah.
Are people going to think this is weird? And I'm like, well, this is who I am. This is how I express myself. That is a piece of being true to myself and putting it out there, knowing that people might have all kinds of reactions to this or to the humor, right? And that's part of it, to just sort of have the voice you have and use it, and that way you get all kinds of reactions. So that's, to me, it was a good exercise and kind of not trying to sound like somebody else, you know. And you know, when you present, when you teach, you have to think about that too. How do you not teach to the smartest person in the room or the person you care the most about what their reaction is, right? But just, teaching from self, speaking and writing from self and letting people do with it what they want. That's a really hard thing. I spend way too much time wondering how people are going to react to using humor or my personality. With a book, it's a little bit easier because you don't see a lot of the reactions, but you know.
Yeah, someone throws it across the room. What do you care? Yeah. So, Kathleen, with our Managing Leadership Anxiety work, we often prescribe television shows and movies because it's the safest place to practice. You get to watch it without being caught in the system. What are a couple of your favorite TV shows that you think are helpful for people to watch to notice anxiety?
Oh, that's a great question. I was a big Succession fan. I mean, you got the family stuff there, right? So I really enjoyed watching that on HBO. Another great HBO show, Big Love. I don't know if you watched it or are familiar with it.
I'm familiar with it. That's the polygamous family.
Yes, and they did such a wonderful job with the family dynamics of that, you know, and then some, because you've got so many players involved, and you've got the generational emotional process and the religion stuff. So that was one of my favorite shows because they did such a great job with those relationship dynamics. But you can watch almost anything and see – if the writing is good, you know, you'll see those triangles, you'll see the overfunctioning piece and the multi-generational process, right? And you're right, it is a wonderful exercise for folks to kind of wrap their mind around. I love to, when I present, I love to show a clip from Everybody Loves Raymond, the sitcom, which is another good one with and the triangle between Raymond, you know, his wife Deborah, and his mother Marie, and how that shifts over time. It's another great example that's funny too. So you can find examples all over the place, and it is a great teaching tool.
Yeah. So okay, in your book, you kick off with self. I think we've covered that enough for this interview. Let's get into the second section of the book where you start having us look at our relationships. And two questions here I'd like to dive into. Here's the first one, Kathleen. Why is family of origin work the hardest work?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. We are so tuned in. I had a client once who said exquisitely tuned in to, I love that phrase, the reactions of our family. You know, this idea that we know people so well, we stop knowing them at all. We stop being curious about them. We make maybe false assumptions about what they think or what they're going to do. We stop seeing them in, as individuals, right? Just because there's that closeness and togetherness. And therefore, it can be one of the hardest places for a person to be a self or an individual, right? Because we are just, things are so much more easily disturbed by people's disappointment or disapproval. It's much harder to shake it off. You know, people are very good at tricking themselves into thinking it doesn't matter, but then those are the people who maybe go home once a year and talk about the weather, right? Yeah. To me, that's a huge impact, whether you realize it or not. And so it's not that you only work on yourself and your family, but I always tell folks you're likely to get more mileage out of it. I liken it to the athletes who train at higher altitudes to get that 1-2% competitive advantage. I think of working on yourself and your family that way. I work with a lot of leaders, a lot of clergy people in particular, and it is just fascinating to see the ones who are really kind of plugging away at their families. They're in it, I think, at a different degree than the folks who are just sort of focusing on whatever the squabble of the week is, you know, at work or in an organization. Because it, you know, if you can do it there, you can almost do it anywhere. Right.
Yeah. We call it doctoral level systems work. Like elementary school is watching it on the television, and then you migrate all the way through to doctorate when you try to figure out your mom and your dad and you with them. But you just said something in that answer that triggered me. I thought it was interesting when you said, you know, people who think it's easy, I'm going to paraphrase the way you said it. Really, in reality, they're only going home once a year and talking about the weather. I've noticed a lot of people use boundaries language when what they're actually doing is detaching or cutting off. And that's what you just described. Just somebody may not see that behavior of cutting off as anxious, as an anxious response. Why is that an anxious response?
Well, it might not always be. I mean, people often have pretty good reasons. So I never presume that contact is the answer to everything. But I do think that's why it's important that people have that multi-generational history of their family and the patterns in their family. Because often a younger person in particular will go, oh, well, I'm doing a new thing. I'm interrupting all these trends. I'm going to be different than my parents were. And then you go back a few generations and you see all the cutoff, right? Or all the distance. And you think, oh, maybe I'm not doing a new thing. I'm just putting a new spin on it, right? You know, is there a different, is there a third way here versus keeping everybody happy or just having nothing to do with them? Maybe not, but perhaps there is, you know. But if you don't have that multi-generational perspective, then I think it's hard for people to see, you know, or they don't see that their response is sort of the flip side, the other side of the coin, right? To maybe family members who are over-involved, or there's so much closeness, right? There's so much conformity that doing the opposite feels like the only way to be, you know, which I can certainly understand.
Yeah. At least in the early days, right? As they try to get equilibrium, sometimes they overcorrect. You know, one of the fun things about your book is how often you put us in the therapy room with you and your clients, and we just get a front row seat to people's lives and what they're carrying, what they're struggling with, how you help them. It's almost a memoir as much as a guidance book. And the way you talk about dating, I think, is so helpful and helping us see people's struggles with dating. I've got a couple of grown kids that are starting to enter that young adult dating world. And as an old man who did all the dating before the social media and all the dating apps, today's dating world seems terrifying. What are you seeing? What's your take on the challenges of dating nowadays?
Well, there are many of them. I feel grateful. I actually met my husband online, but this was pre-apps. So I feel personally very grateful that I never had to go through that. But, you know, I always think that we're up against the same things, these same ways we calm ourselves down, right? But it's just that much harder largely because of technology. These behaviors the ways we respond to stress are not new, right? But they are perhaps easier to access. And let me give you an example. So often we rely on reassurance or hearing from others to calm ourselves down, right? And what people are up against with dating now is because it's easy to just like text somebody or check in with somebody all the time, people get reliant on hearing back from the person they're dating to feel calmer about the potential or the future of the relationship, right? So I talk with a lot of people who are like, I cannot calm down until this person has texted me back or called me and said, maybe not calling so much, let's be realistic, yeah. But like, had a great time, would love to see you again, you know, or how are you doing today? My day's going well. You know, and I'm thinking back where, like, let's go back 100 years. You don't have that constant check-in. Like, people just had to be okay with not hearing back from somebody for a while, right? Let's even go pre-telephone, right? It could be days or weeks even, right? Or months. We don't have that capacity anymore. We are increasingly reliant on others to calm us down about how we feel about things are going, right? And so people quickly get trapped into, oh, this person doesn't text me enough, or I get really anxious about the relationship. That has become my only way of calming down. And then you get trapped into these scenarios of, how do I keep this person interested versus how do I be myself and let it play out based on that, right? What are my principles for being respectful, honest, about what I believe, about what's okay, what's not okay. It's so much easier now to kind of get trapped into, well, I want to keep this person on this app interested, so let me answer how I think they want me to, right? And that has always existed to some degree, but I think technology has kind of amplified it, if that makes sense. So people just, I feel like they lose their sense of self so much more quickly in dating. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, a couple months down the road and they're going, why did I waste all this energy trying to keep this person happy who's not actually a good fit for me? You know, we're not that compatible. And if I had just been honest on date number two, we would have saved ourselves a bunch of time, you know? And so I think that because of the apps, because it is sort of more gamified, that sort of desire to appear likable, desirable, accommodating, you know, it's just hard to kind of get out of that. So it's tough. But I hope that thinking about differentiation of self and focusing on yourself and what you can control is useful for people when their phone makes it so easy to find other ways to calm down with dating. So that was a long answer, but you know, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, no, that was a wonderful answer, especially just the way you helped us think through the anxious need for speed, just the anxious need for instant validation. And I guess I'm also thinking, you know, when I was dating, pre-apps, pre-internet, I'm an old fella. You had all of the capacity of the natural human intuition when you're in the same room as someone. You can observe them. You can there was still all that pretense and anxiety and nervousness, but it just felt like there was more, I don't know, colors on the palette that you could paint with. And then online, it just feels like a lot of that's been taken away. And it's got to be true, Kathleen, that there's just an underlying anxiety. Will I ever find somebody that I can be myself with? And how do I begin to do that? And when do I begin to do that? That just has to be new added pressure, I would think. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, and I think people are measuring success, I don't want to say in the wrong way, but maybe in an unhelpful way. I hear from a lot of people who say, oh, I'm worried about my because I haven't dated anybody more than a couple of months. As if dating somebody for 2 years and then breaking up is a measure of success, right? You know, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, maybe you're just better at figuring out more quickly whether you want to continue a relationship or not, right?
Yeah.
Length of time does not, to me, is not a, necessarily a good measure, because it becomes about how long can I keep somebody interested versus what do I want for myself, you know, and for my future, and can I get a sense of that from somebody else as well?
Yeah. Okay. So for my listeners who want to practice differentiation on a first date, what might that look like? Obviously it's different for every person, but what might be some general guiding principles there?
Yeah. What does it look like to be myself? What, what am I interested in? What am I about? What is useful to communicate with somebody right off the bat? So we don't, I mean, you don't want to scare somebody, but you also don't want to waste anybody's time, right? what does it look like for me to be respectful and interested and a good listener, right? That is very different than how did this person react to me? Do they like me or not? Those are all things out of your control, right? And I think it can be calming for people to ask themselves those good questions. You know, what is my job here? Maybe it's to look nice, be present, and be myself. Maybe that's it. You know, put often the wisdom you can put on a post-it is the is the best wisdom for anything, including a date, right? And then after it, a person can go back to that thinking and go, did I do my job? Did I do those things? Well, maybe not. Maybe I need to work on this a little bit. That's it. You know, how the person responds, that's entirely up to them. If you like them, it would be nice if they liked you too, but that's not, you know. And I think having something to focus on that's controllable can be useful for people. Because we very so quickly, especially with dating, go to what the other person is, how they're reacting.
Hey, listeners. Hey, I went to seminary in the 1990s, and I would describe it as transformative to my faith. Our professors exposed us to scholars who helped us understand the cultural context of the Bible. They also helped us approach our faith in a holistic and integrated way. They, I'd say, significantly expanded my Christian worldview way beyond my own culture. What's amazing to me is how many of these authors, the people that were on the spines of my books, are now accessible to all of us. Seminary Now is a streaming video platform where you can learn from some of the finest Christian thinkers of our time. They've got some incredible Bible scholars, but I also really appreciate how they host so many voices and thinkers from non-majority culture. So you can learn from them theology, Old Testament, New Testament, but also justice, reconciliation, church issues, the contemplative life, and perspectives that are not yours. You'll even find my video course on managing anxiety on Seminary Now. They release new courses every month, and for just $20 a month, you get access to all of it. But I've been given a special offer that I can pass on to you. Managing Anxiety podcast listeners get 30% off You just go to seminarynow.com/cuss and you use cuss30 at the checkout. Kathleen, here's the reality. You have a doctorate. You're a therapist that's always around anxious people. However, you have not yet in your life endured the gauntlet of anxiety questions. So let me just see. I'll throw 3 to 5 questions to you. Here's number one. How do you know when you're not well?
Oh, I am so focused on other people behaving badly. It becomes an art, right? When I'm ready to write a paper on someone else's immaturity, then I know I've gone to the dark side or into a bad place. And that's a sign for me to reel it back and put my focus where it needs to be. So that's pretty useful for me to pay attention to.
Fantastic. In the spirit of blame and focusing on others, we all tend to have types of people or types of behaviors in others that trigger us. What might be one or two behaviors in another person that's kind of guaranteed to generate reactivity in your life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think maybe it's because I'm an only child, which we tend to be more like oldest child, just people who are sitting around waiting for other people to tell them what to do. I mean, in a good sense, it's a good fit because then I can tell them what to do. But it's just hard for me to relate to people who are just kind of hanging out looking for direction because I so often operate the opposite way. So it's difficult for me to relate to people who aren't just anxiously doing things all the time because that's my comfort zone.
So good. Okay, question.
Yeah, I have something to learn from those people.
Okay. Sure, yeah. Okay, third question. When you think about your family of origin, obviously there's genogram work and deep work, but at a very simple level, what might be one asset and one liability that you've inherited from your family of origin?
Yeah, so this is the asset and the liability. Like I said before, I'm the only child of an oldest daughter of a woman who functioned like an oldest daughter in her family. So people who are over-involved, particularly in their churches, in helping others, which is a wonderful thing in many ways, but also a liability because it's very, like I said, it's very easy to get over-involved with others' responses. So I think that helping instinct, that wanting to jump in and be creative and do a thing is great energy, but also it can be, it can overlook other people's talents and capabilities. Why aren't you doing things the way I'm doing them? So I have to be careful about that and let other people be themselves also.
Thank you. Okay. Okay. You are, I'm very disappointed at how well you're sailing through the gauntlet. So I'm not happy unless others are uncomfortable. Question number 4, I think all of us have a gap between our belief and our experience. And so those of us who are people of faith, you know, we believe in God's love, but we don't always experience it. Or we believe that God has given us freedom and yet we felt bound. But even people who are not of faith, they have beliefs with a gap. What might be a gap between what you believe and what you experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's ultimately that idea of why worry about tomorrow? It's covered. God's got you. I can say that that's a part of my belief system, but I often don't operate that way, right? I'm very, very focused on achieving or securing things or making sure my daughter is doing what she needs to be doing, when often it would be very helpful for me to be reminded of that truth as I believe it and to allow myself and others to be cared for and other people's expressions of their beliefs and God's love and what a gift that is. It's so easy to get into that we have to take care of ourselves mindset these days in our anxious society, right? It's always useful for me to be reminded of that because we seldom, or at least me, I'll speak for myself, I seldom operate that way.
Okay. All right, final question. When in your life lately have you felt most fully and completely loved?
That's a good question. Well, I have a 4-year-old, so I mean, I get that all the time. You know, you're my best friend. I love you so much. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, there's an end to this. Teenagers are coming. But I'm really basking in that now. And I'd also have to say in my church, you know, just the relationships with people who, you know, who aren't my age, who don't look like me, who are doing different things, that like multi-generational community is so important to me. To just, because it's so easy these days to get into our little bubbles of people who are exactly like us. That's just such a important part of my life. And so I always feel very loved in that community. But I have to say my daughter, because I get that all the time. I'm her favorite person. It's good for the ego.
Kathleen, I read Everything Isn't Terrible not long after it came out, and it quickly became my favorite systems book. It's such an honor for me that you join me on the show. I know you have another book coming out next year, which for me is just a great excuse to have you come back on next year and tell us. But thank you so much for coming on Managing Leadership Anxiety.
Thank you, Steve. It was fun.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.